Hey, we welcome you to part two of our conversation with pandemics and protests as we deal with the weight of it all. We have been blessed with part one. If you did not get a chance to listen to part one, please go back and listen to part one. It is episode 13, part one. Coming up is part two of our conversation. It was so much profundity with these doctors that were part of the panel. This particular episode, or this part of the episode, is brought to you by Summit Signs. Summit Signs. We know that this is Juneteenth. This recording is coming out. This episode is coming out on Juneteenth, and we want to make sure that we support minority-owned businesses. And so this particular episode is sponsored by Summit Signs. If you have printing needs, graphic needs, please go see our friends over at Summit Signs, which is located in Universal City. If you are out of town, just catch them on Facebook, like their page on Facebook, get in touch with them no matter where you are in the country. They will be a blessing to you. Let's support minority-owned businesses. Again, contact Summit Signs, one of our sponsors here at Church Unfiltered. Well, let's get to part two of our discussion, the pandemics and protests, with our dynamic, highly educated panel as they continue to share what is upon their hearts. There was something added to all of this. We were dealing with the grocery stores being empty and the this and that, toilet paper not available, all of these different things, having to stay in the house, doing curbside if you did that, whatever the case. We're dealing with all of those things, and then we see a video of a man jogging and gunned down. Then we see a video of a woman in Central Park calling the police, threatening to say, there's a black man attacking me. Then we see the culmination of all of this in seeing a police officer on the neck of Brother George Floyd. On top of all the pandemic stress and strain, we begin to see these images. I want us to transition into talking about that. We're dealing with a heavy burden. But for us, people of color, African Americans, the burden, it was as if someone, if you're lifting weights and someone is pushing down instead of spotting you lifting up to give you relief, it was like someone's pushing down. And I just can't lift this weight. And that's why I wanted us to come together and have this particular episode and this dialogue, because this is heavy. And I needed folks like you all to help me to understand some things. Let me just ask you, first and foremost, where were you when you saw those videos? Where were you mentally, emotionally, when you saw Brother Ahmaud Arbery gunned down? Where were you when you heard that Central Park exchange? Where were you when you saw that police officer on the neck of Brother George Floyd? And not physically, where were you? I mean, if you want to share that, that's fine too, but where were you when you saw that? And where are you now?
I think I'll start. You know, I can tell you where I was at home. And I think where I was mentally and emotionally, when all of those incidents happened, I think some people are surprised, but none of that shocked me. And so, you know, I grew up, you know, Rodney King was my introduction to that stuff.
Yeah.
I was a young teenager. Amadou Diallo was stuff that introduced me to these kinds of things. And so the Central Park, you know, the young Central Park kids, you know, so I do, don't be hanging out and, you know, it things happen there.
Right, right.
So I think for me, I was kind of numb. Not that I wasn't affected by it, but it's just these things have happened so long. And maybe also because of the work that I do, you know, when I do classes on on lynching and all those kinds of things. And so nothing surprised me. I think what surprised me was, usually these things have always been placed on African Americans to carry the entire load. And it's usually African Americans saying, George Floyd could be my brother. George Floyd could be this. George Floyd could be that. Ahmaud Arbery could be this. And it seemed like other people started saying things in a way that we've always been the ones that carry the burden. Nobody said Trayvon Martin, other than black people, could be my son.
Right, right.
You know, and so something else has shifted, and I'm probably getting ahead of it. And so I think that changed me mentally around. And then it took me at least a week before I was ever prepared. I still can't watch the video of George Floyd. It's hard for me to watch that. So I can't. And I think also I felt that even though other people were taking a burden, I kind of rejected some of the thoughts out there of we all have to make a stand. And I didn't say anything because I think, you know, having to come out and automatically, I wasn't at an emotional state at that point that I was capable of coming out and saying, this is how I believe, this is this, this is that. And I think that we may want to discuss the emotional effects of all that pressure coming back to having to respond and being expected to respond to something that you haven't quite grasped yet. Yeah. I've been grasping all of this stuff before. I had to still have that time to be ready in a sense, in a way that I'm trying to self-care too,
right,
to be able to say something and to speak.
That's good. That's good. Wow. Okay.
Dr. Lattimore hit the nail on the head with regard to just I needed space, and I feel like I really, especially in my military capacity, at the same time as all of this was going on in our world, there was a report that came out, an official Air Force report that was publicly released that spoke to the realities of the injustice in the Air Force justice system toward African Americans. And so, and then even within our own chaplain corps, a memo that had been long forgotten resurfaced from almost 20 years ago from our former, well, I guess it was our deputy chief of chaplains at the time, who went on to become the chief of chaplains. She made the comment in a meeting, in a private meeting, and it became public that black chaplains are great at preaching, but they're terrible at administrative work. So essentially don't promote them to particular positions. And so, you know, I was and am in some ways in a numb place. I wanted to have the time to be able to sit back and really gather my thoughts. But I think some people looked at my background, some people of ivory hue looked at my background in particular and said, you know, Fred, what do you have to say about these things? You know, and in the back of my mind, and I know this is a podcast, I'm gonna say this the right way, I was like, you know, figure it out on your own, you know. And I was not impressed by the fact that we had all of these woke white people all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. I was, in my mind, I was like, what took you so darn long?
Yeah.
You know, this is what we've been saying the whole time. And so, yeah, so I mean, that's kind of that, quite in full transparency, that's still where I am.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Dr. Aisha.
So I as well have not watched any of those videos. I know that I'm just not in a place that I'm going to be able to tolerate that visually. I will tell you that for whatever reason, Ahmaud Arbery's murder took me down a street. I just was not prepared to go to the point that I don't think I have still fully sat with what's happened with George Floyd, even though I understand that's kind of the firestorm that took off. But in the midst of having a conversation about this experience with my training director, who happens to be a black woman, our associate training director, who happens to be a black man, And we were creating a space for us to just talk about this in the early days of, okay, we have to continue, you know, we have students to support. We're seeing an influx of Black students that are reaching out to Duke CAPS and saying, hey, I need to talk to a Black clinician. And me in particular feeling like I don't have nothing to give them right now. Like literally, I don't, they're going to ask for something that I'm normally very prepared. I cannot, all we're going to be able to do is sit. And I kept talking about the image that I had in my head with Ahmaud Arbery and this murder taking place. And this guy and his son literally just went home afterwards. They just went home. And they took showers and they went to bed and they got up the next morning and had coffee after killing someone. They just went home. And it was months before we, community, found out that this was what took place. And I started calculating, if that happened twice a month in each state, every day, and my mind went down this path. And I said, okay, come on, bring it back, bring it back, bring it back. So in this instance, what I've had to do is as a really strong separation, and I'm having to compartmentalize in a way that still allows me to be very present for my students. But this forced social isolation is forcing me to ask myself, what was it about this one in particular that caused my own response to be so sharp? And that is one of these things that might be a whole nother podcast about how people deal in isolation. And people really struggle because they don't want to have the hard conversations with themselves. And in this season, you're forced to, because you don't have all of the extracurriculars that you put on your schedule and bombard yourself with. You are literally sitting with you and your thoughts. And you are now forced to ask her some questions. And along with what Dr. Lattimore said, and even Dr. Brock jumped a little bit on this, I really believe this is the reason that we have a lot of white folk that are all of a sudden woke. Mm-hmm. They've been sitting in their thoughts and cannot probably quite come up with a rationale that makes this okay. Mm-hmm. I had a client, a Caucasian client, who apologized to me for calling Kaepernick a name when he kneeled. And she said, I was so wrong. And I'm literally sitting at the Zoom like this. I said, Aisha, your doctorate is 2 days away. Don't let her get you. Don't let her get you. I had to talk myself off the ledge because this here we have this white woman who probably was very sincere in her experience and what she was sharing, but is asking for my Black pass to tell her it's okay. It's all right that you didn't know. We glad you're here now. It ain't in me. And I think that's what a lot of people are now finding themselves struggling with, where we as a people, we it's ingrained in us, we forgive. And for whatever purpose, you know, when outrage happens about other things and people protest and people get mad, change happens. But when it comes to the Black community, you need to learn how to forgive. And I think we're out of forgiveness. We're out of that. And I don't speak that from a spiritual context. I speak it very much from a race of people that are exhausted and that are tired and that are starting to recognize their power. Mm-hmm. Coming together, there is some power. We talk about what's happened in these protests and start identifying changes that have been made in various cities. There is power in the protests. There is power in the voice. And I think this is the generation of people that are starting to realize, wait a minute. They was onto something with that Montgomery bus boycott. It took 381 days, but they were onto something. And that is what has been giving me a little bit of life. That, okay, we're going to make it through this. We've made it through worse. We've made it through ugliness. We're going to make it through this.
Yeah. And I think that each of you have said something, and I want us to kind of expound upon that, is our response to our white brothers and sisters' response. We're seeing a number of white pastors. I knew that there was going to be a difference in the way that things were handled when I started seeing some of the white pastors that that I get many resources from, different things like that. I started seeing Andy Stanley and Craig Rochelle, and I have nothing against these brothers, but when I saw them responding to it, I'm like, okay, yeah, this is about to be different. This is about to be different. And so there's this challenge of we wanna have a dialogue, we wanna have a conversation. And I know Dr. Lattimore, I think I just saw that you were on another podcast just recently and having dialogue in this same vein. But I think that how do we have conversations with our white brothers and sisters in relation to this when that feeling is there? Because I echo what you all are saying. I have had conversations that have actually upset me to have those conversations instead of me being in a place of, oh, well, this is good that I'm able to now sit down with this person or that person. But it was like you said, Dr. Brock, it's like, where have you been? And I wasn't shocked either, Dr. Lattimore. I think what it was for me was just, as Dr. Aisha said, I had time to just, you know what, I'm just tired of this. That's what it was for me. It's just, I'm just tired. I'm tired of this. And I think that time, that slow schedule and everything like that just gave me time to process it differently than times. And that's one of the things I want our listeners, because we have people of all backgrounds listening. This is not new. We deal with this over and over and over again. And so, let's talk about that. How do we talk to them? How do we talk to our white brothers and sisters who may be sincere? They really do want to engage in conversation. They really want to do something different. And then you may have some that are just, and let's be honest, there may be some that are saying it because they have African-Americans in their congregation, or they have African-Americans that buy their product and things. And I mean, that's this church unfiltered. This is the truth. And they're just doing it because they don't want to lose those people. They don't want to lose those dollars. But I do believe that there are some sincere brothers and sisters that want to have a conversation. How do we do, Dr. Lattimore, how do you do it?
You know, it's something that I've always had to do. I mean, when you go into a classroom, you are educating a person, but you're also, in a sense, I see it also as a ministry to a person. And that's an opportunity, you know. I think for me, I look at it as a ministry thing. I'm sure Jesus got sick and tired of talking to some people too.
Oh, yeah. His disciples, he got tired of them.
And all these people, you know, they wouldn't listen, or they wouldn't do this, or they didn't stand up when it was necessary. They left him at, you know, they did all these different kinds of things, and Jesus still loved them.
Right.
And I think that that's where I'm trying to come off, is that, to me, empathy is always the most important thing. Studies show that our levels of empathy as a society have gone down over the last 40 years.
Yeah.
I can't reject my brothers and sisters who have questions. And I can't throw them out the door, because who knows, that person may have an effect on somebody, in the same way that mentoring, you know, if we mentor a young person, we don't know what that young person might do. They may end up being the president of the United States, and that little opportunity that we had to influence them may have made all the difference.
Good.
And so to me, if we really want to do this work, this ministry work, it's going to be arduous. It's going to be difficult, but we got to seize the moment. And then I also want to talk about the idea of maybe some people want to do it for business. Well, that's what civil rights was all about too. I mean, there's a reason, you know, Montgomery bus boycott was business too. They were affecting those people's business. San Antonio was integrated, desegregated the lunch counters, because those business owners were afraid that if those things came in them, they were going to lose business. So all these things, in a sense, can be opportunities. And if that means that there's not another George Floyd, that we prevent one George Floyd, I'll take the hit of talking to one or two more people. If that protects your child or my, you know, people that we know, if it makes their life a little bit easier, that's what our ancestors have been doing from the beginning. It's tiring, But my ancestors, my parents, they stepped out there for me. I got to pay it forward in a sense.
Yeah. Can you imagine the conversations that they had to have?
And it's about love. Wow. You know, I still love and I believe in empathy. Somebody had empathy on me for me in many senses, which I didn't understand and which I failed.
That's good.
They forgave me. I can't boast.
That's good. That's good. Dr. Brock, you have anything to add to that?
I was thinking as Dr. Lattimore was talking, we are currently at the Message Church, we're going through this study from the book of Titus that we have entitled Order in the Church. And I'm thinking of verse 13 in Titus chapter 1, where Paul gives Titus some very strong instructions for these rebellious people, false teachers who are teaching in Crete. He says, reprove them severely so that they may be strong in their faith, you know? And for me, as we even seek to embrace the culture that we're creating at the Message Church of keeping it real relevant and relational, which we equate to, my thoughts are leaving. I want to make sure I stay focused on what I'm saying. So as we have conversations with our white brothers and sisters, my goal has been to simply be honest. Mm-hmm. And to keep it real relevant and relational in that way. And to tell my white sisters and brothers that if you love me, you're gonna love me where I am as I am. And if it means that day I'm angry, then love me while I'm angry, even if you don't quite fully understand, so that we can come to some type of basic level, you know, just exercise some basic level of empathy as we have this conversation. And so that's been my approach, just to, and maybe it's the old linebacker coming in, coming out of me, but I'm a firm believer in I don't believe in jumping around the pink elephants in the room. If racism is the issue, let's run down the a-hole and attack racism, and let's have a conversation if you want to have a conversation.
Wow, that's good. That's good. That's good stuff. And thank you for reminding us about being a linebacker. Dr. Aisha, I'm hearing, and this is good stuff, and I think that it's important for us definitely to have those conversations. But what does it mean, or what will it do for us to have those conversations despite our inclination to want to distance ourselves or want to dismiss that person? What does it do for us as far as even emotionally and mentally?
I actually think that someone made mention of that just a bit ago. It may have been you, Dr. Cobbs, of the idea of having these conversations and finding yourself getting more worked up, becoming more angry in the midst of these dialogues. I would say to you and anybody else, if that's happening, you're not in a position to have those conversations.
That's good.
Take care of your mental health first. Mm. Do not attach the burden of teaching white folk or any other folk how to address systemic racism, how to address injustice, how to address diversity and inclusion. We have a habit of taking this on as though we have the problem, and we don't. And I think that's one of the things we really need to keep in mind in this season. If you are in the capacity where you can speak from a place of love, where you can speak from a place of calmness and have a state of mind that will allow you to be sincere and having a dialogue, by all means do so. But if you are not, even in the slightest, do not feel obligated just because you're being asked. And I think that is a very difficult position for a leader in the first place, because as a leader, when someone comes to you and asks, what do? You lead.
Right.
And this is the reason we find ourselves in this hamster wheel, because we are continuously answering questions, whether we are on a full tank or whether, like Dr. Brock said, at the end of March, running on fumes. And I can guarantee you any message, any question that came, he was still answering. So I want people to get out of this space that because they're being asked, they owe response and explanation. And that's simply not true.
Wow.
The flip side of that is, if you are not in that situation, I keep an arsenal of literature through various Division 17, which is the counseling and psychology division of the APA. And they send out all kinds of free webinars, books. I'm very quick to say, hey, I can't have that conversation right now, but I want to send you something that I think will be helpful. And that has been very refreshing to me, because I felt like I've still been able to respond, and I haven't put myself at any risk that I'm not prepared to deal with. Right now, for me, the focus is not only my mental health, but the mental health of the students I'm working with. I still have a job to do, and I still have students that are in tears. I still have students that are going to protest and then coming and sitting an hour with me. Yeah. And everything that they're laying down, I'm of course picking up, wow. Right? That's my job as a clinician. So for me, it's very important not to add to that by feeling obligated to answer questions when there are resources and information available. Go do your work.
Mm.
So that's when that word. Question is asked to me, go do your work. And yeah. If you sincerely don't know where to start, I can guide you. I can help you. I can provide you with those resources. But you go do your work.
Wow.
That freed me. I'm free now.
Is that not a blessing? And I want
let me put my Cash App up there so y'all can pay tithes.
You just ministered for every pastor listening. Because that applies across the board. If you're not in a position to do it, if you can't have that conversation, and that's one of the things that I was mentioning earlier, I'm hearing conversations taking place from people who are in bad places, and they are trying to answer every question, every question. And I'm like, no, please take some time to get healthy. If you don't get anything else from this episode, take the time to get healthy so that you can be a help to those that you serve. Wow. Thank you. Thank you so much for that. I want to ask this and we'll just ask a couple of more things and we'll wrap up. One of the things that I thought about is, as I'm seeing different pastors coming together, I'm seeing the different panels and the discussions that are taking place. I'm seeing white pastors, black pastors, And it still does not take away from the fact that prior to the pandemic, which I believe I'm not going to rest all of my theological laurels on this or anything like that, but I really believe that the Lord slowed us down because obviously he knew that these things were coming, and it just gives us opportunity to look at it differently, for the church to look at it differently. But one of the things that we don't like to talk about, and it's there every day, is how segregated we are in churches. We, white church, black church, Spanish church, that we're so divided at times. And so I wanted us to talk about that, because I'm listening to different things that are happening now, different responses that are taking place, but I'm not hearing anything that is saying from the different forums and panels, I'm not hearing anything that is leading towards desegregation, if you will, of our Sunday service, worship services. As a consultant, when I go into a church, I look at the staff. Church leaders will say, we're a multicultural church. I look at the staff. If the staff is all white or all black, I'm like, no, you're not. You're not a multicultural church. You may have some sprinkles in there, but why is the church in 2020? And I know, Dr. Lattimore, you're a historian and everything, but why is the church still so segregated? Why? And Dr. Brock, you went to great schools, and stood out. You are definitely a scholar in the schools you've gone to, but even some of the schools that you're connected to is white churches, is black churches. Why is that still so prevalent nowadays?
Maybe it's praise and worship, because I mean, this is unfiltered. I just want
to... That's another episode.
Okay then. I'm a backup then.
The music.
I'm reminded of an interview that the late Reverend Dr. Samuel DeWitt Proctor did, and he actually mentioned that desegregation was one of the worst things to ever happen to the black community. Mm-hmm. And I'm paraphrasing here, but he actually, when he mentioned that, he spoke to the reality that in black communities by and large, that, desegregation, you know, there was this strong communal sensibility that may or may not, you know, arguably exist now. There's a way that we care for our own that does not happen many times, at least in my own experience in predominantly white institutions, be it church, education, and so forth. And so, for my part, I don't know. I've never felt a call to a multi-ethnic church. Even our church has multiple ethnicities, but you know, we're predominantly African American, and my heart has always been in addressing issues that are in and within the black community. And so I don't know if, I think if that's your church's call, then of course, as you have shared before, Dr. Cobbs, that the staff needs to reflect it, you know, and other things need to reflect it as well. But I think just as far as the message church is concerned, at least in this season, we feel pretty clear about what our call is. And this is a great season, I believe, to be called to the black community.
Wow. Thank you. Dr. Latimer?
I really can't add anything too much to the great comments that were there. I think there's a history. I mean, you know, do you give up the AME church? Do you give up the historical Black Baptist church or the Black Catholic churches and, you know, and those things and that have evolved? But at the same time, and also, we are still segregated in our living spaces. When you think about it. And so that's an impediment when you think about it, that many white people don't live around black people.
Right.
Those are just the truths of the matter. And in a situation like now, you want to be able to go to a place where things are truly equal and that expectations, like, how should I say this? And I'm going to try to be as politically conscious as possible. But we often, the three of us, four, we work in white spaces. And there are extra jobs that are added on to that because we're black people in those spaces. And we do extra work that sometimes doesn't go recognized because we do the other kinds of little things. In a black church, in environment, we don't have to do that because it has often freed us to be ourselves. And you know, W.B. Du Bois talked about a two-ness, that, you know, a double consciousness. We're American and then we're black, and these two sometimes fight against each other. And until we handle these racial issues, I don't know if we're going to have to do it, there are impediments to all of these, because the onus is still going to be on black people to do certain things, those unexpected job things that don't get recognized. I'm not discounting multiracial, multi-ethnic churches, not at all. And they're going to happen. The black church is going to have to open up to interracial relationships and children of mixed race ancestry in a much more profound way, because that's going to be your congregation. And is the black church going to be able to work that in the way that the non-denominational churches seem to have done a better job at? Are they going to be able to celebrate other ethnic groups in a way that doesn't dismiss these other children. But I'm going a lot of different directions, but I just think that there are so many things. And to me, you know, I want Christ to be preached.
Yeah.
And you know, there are different ways of doing that. And I think some people are in certain places that they need certain things, and we need different churches to reflect those people at their needs where they are at that point in time.
Right, right.
And Dr. Kauza,
go ahead.
If I may add to that, and thank you, Dr. Lattimore, for that. One of the things that we have chosen to do as a church is, as I mentioned before, just really focus on, I think, what is a distinctive of the Black church and Black people in general, that communal sensibility piece, even with the diversity that we have, to say, look, you know, when you come and you're part of a Black church, we just love you. And we, you know, whether you polka dot, purple, black, white, whatever. And we celebrate the diversity that we have in our predominantly Black church. And you know that, Dr. Kauza, we reached out to Resurrection, and we had one of your awesome pastors come over and assist us during our Hispanic Heritage Month. And, you know, so we seek to highlight things like that across the calendar year, to really emphasize that we are African American in the greatest sense of what both words mean. So I just want to add that.
That's good. That's good. Yeah. That's good. And I think that we're in the conversations that are taking place now, it is rising to the surface. How can we have these conversations when we know what our church looks like? Our church is made up. And then you add on top of that, then there are political slants that come from the pulpit and have always been there, as I'm sure Dr. Lattimore could elaborate on. That's been there. But how do we bring all of this together? We have the things that are taking place, the racial tension, all the things that are happening, the conversations that are taking place. How do we bring that together with the reality? What the reality is that we know we're going to go back. If church is all opened up now, we're going back to the same white church, Black church. How do we have that conversation now and deal with some of the things that are prevalent at the moment, and hopefully in the coming days, and be honest about what is really there, that segregated hour, as has been said, that church hour? How do we really have that conversation when we know that it's separate? And Dr. Aisha, you made reference to praise and worship, and I know that you were, well, you were joking, but really it is true. There's so many differences, and it's okay. I don't think there's just a problem with us having differences, but I think that when we have a conversation about racial reconciliation and we're trying to come together, well, are we really going to come together? And that's both sides. Do we need to come together? Is there benefit for that? I know I'm asking a lot of questions, but I just wanted us to, as we kind of bring all of this together, how do we even get to that place of racial reconciliation when our church structures, our church systems are white, Black, Hispanic, and then you have some multicultural, but then you have some, you know, let, you know, that's a whole nother discussion that could take place. Yeah. How often do you see a Black pastor that has white members? I was told that directly, that I probably would not be able to have a multicultural church because white people would not follow a Black pastor. I was told that directly by some of my white brothers, and they were right. They were right. We had a few whites that showed up and they drifted away. But how do we have that conversation when we know that there's separation? Is that even realistic?
I think it's realistic, but I think one of the things that I mentioned earlier, that if we're going to have a real conversation, we must keep in mind. There's an issue of trust here. There is an issue of trust in the Black church. And when I say issue of trust, meaning I think about what it takes for me to join a ministry, the vetting process that I go through, the time that I spend in a ministry. I belong to three churches in my 36 years of life. And that's all been by design, because the church is where I trust. And there is going to be a difficulty if we are talking about being sincere about merging churches from a racial perspective, when right now racial tensions are so high and there's such a lack of trust. I can't tell you that I'm going to move from my spiritual place of comfort in an effort to extend the olive branch and say, all right, let's try to do this, when every system that I'm a part of does this.
Yeah, absolutely.
And right now, as we're talking about, you know, the pandemic, and we're talking about these racial issues that are happening, and we're talking about the doors of the physical church being locked and people longing for their safety net, the one thing I wouldn't want to do is walk back in, and I'm looking up, and it's funny for me to say this, but then I see the white pastor and I'm like, who is that? But not the one I'm married to, like another one. Right? You know, and finding myself in a situation where I'm like, but this is my safe. This is where I know when they're preaching, there's not an agenda. I know that when a conversation or a Bible study is being taught, or when a message is going forward, I don't have the feeling of having to second guess. And as long as we continue to have where the structural racism is involved in all of these systems, I think it's going to be very difficult to be sincere in the idea of merging churches in a racial way.
Wow. Thank you. Dr. Lattimore?
You know, churches, even black churches themselves, have a hard time merging. So, I mean, that's why we have billions of black Baptist churches on every street corner. And I say this as a Baptist. I think the question is, when you have the economic disparities that we have, mm-hmm. that a black family is going to earn 10%, you know, their wealth is going to be 10% of an average white family, or the unemployment rate's going to be double for African Americans, that really, you know, the differentiation on unemployment rate really hasn't changed between blacks and whites over the last 50 years. People commune in environments of people that share commonalities. That's the right. theoretic meaning of a community. Right. And so until you see these kinds of structural inequities addressed, I think we're going to have a hard time, because when that happens, then you're going to have to ask the question, on whose terms? You know, integration didn't happen on black people's terms. Mm. You know, wow. You take two school districts, and who became the vice principal, who became the principal? Mm. Baseball was not integrated in an equal way because the teams decided that they were going to have one black person or two, and that was it. And you had the White Sox that didn't bring a black person on until like 59-60. But it destroyed the Negro Leagues. And wow. So we have to be very cautious in the idea of the terms. They have to be equal. They have to be just. It can't just be integrating for integration's sake. That's desegregation. Integration means full equality in bringing people together, not desegregation, which means just putting you together and saying you're equal now. Wow. So I think that that's kind of what you have to have.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, that's that. And that's the conversation that I'm not hearing. That's exactly it. And I think that you hit it right on the head, that we need to understand that it needs to be more to this conversation than what's happening right now. And it has been said several times that the burden or the onus has been upon African Americans, and so that's why we're talking about all the things we've talked about this episode. You have people who are tired, you have people who are exhausted, you have people who are weary from various things, and so now we are being brought to the table. Okay, now we're being brought to the table. Tell me how to fix this. Like, I'm just trying to not break down during today. I'm just trying to not So I can't come with that answer. We have to do this thing collectively. But you just hit it right up on the head, Dr. Lattimore. There's so many components to that answer. There's so many components to it. And until we are ready to really talk about it, I think that some of the conversations that are taking place are surface, and in a month or two, again, we'll go back to doing what we do. If we're not ready to talk about economics, and that's not what's coming up in the conversation. What's coming up in conversation is help me to understand why you're angry. Okay. That's deeper dialogue that needs to take place. And then what will help us not to be angry? That's just a whole nother conversation. I don't know if the church is ready for that or not. What do you all think? Do you think church is ready for it? This church is filtered. Just tell us.
No, I don't think so. And I think, you know, you hit on something, Dr. Cobbs. Dr. Lattimore also spoke to it. We can't even agree to, like, we're not even speaking on the same terms. And I mean, I guess in my mind, maybe because I have all of these academicians on right now, I was thinking, you know, when you're writing an academic paper, sometimes at the beginning of the paper, you define some key terms to help guide you, to help guide your reading throughout the paper. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we as African Americans, like, we can't even get white people to agree that we're on the definitions of the terms that we're talking about. You know, what does it look like, you know, to really integrate? You know, what is it? What does equality mean? What does equity mean? What does inclusion mean? What does diversity mean versus tokenism? You know, I mean, all of these various things, we can't even agree on terminology. So we can't, it's hard to have a conversation when we're speaking two totally different languages. Like, there has to be a whole language class before we can even have a conversation.
Wow. Wow. That's good. So where do we start? What's the hope? What's the hope in this in all of this? We recognize where we are, what some of the obstacles are. What is the hope in all of this? Go ahead, Dr. Brock.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the hope lies in that God is still God, you know, and nothing is impossible with God. I think of Luke 1:37, nothing is impossible with God. You know, I think of Mary asking the question when she was told that she was going to be the bearer of the Christ child. She asked the question, how can this be? You know, how shall this be?
Yeah.
And I mean, I think we're standing at a moment in history where we're asking the question, how shall this be? And we need sons of Issachar like yourself and podcasts like Church Unfiltered by the sons of Issachar who knew the signs of the time, you know, to help lead us through how this can be. And so, I mean, I'm hopeful because of podcasts like this. I'm hopeful because God is still calling people to various areas of ministry, whether it be psychology, academia, church ministry, consulting, whatever the case is. That's what gives me hope, the fact that God is still giving utterance through called people.
That's good. That's good. What's the hope, Dr. Lattimore?
You know, I teach young kids, and you know, they, you know, even before this, they were much more attuned to certain things than people in the past. But, you know, so I'm hopeful on them, but I'm an optimist. I you know, hearing the stories of my ancestors who were, you know, telling the stories of being a slave, I grew up in the same area that my ancestors were enslaved in. We grew up around the people, you know, to see where they came from. And I still can see progress in that. And I know that that progress is slow. And I know that it should be more. Mm-hmm. But I still know that I worship a God whose blessings are abundant.
Yeah.
And so I have to have optimism because I believe in him. And I always have. And it was the hope that my parents gave to me, because if you don't have that hope, then what do you have?
Right.
You know, if we don't believe that things will get better, that's nihilistic thinking. I mean, I just don't know what we become. And as a church, as believers, I have optimism because I know what the world offers. And I know that the world is not going to offer me anything that is sustainable. So my hope is that the king, you know, being with you guys has, you know, I'm going to be honest, has refreshed me. You don't know in all the kinds of ways that sharing my experiences with you have given me hope in the things that I'm doing, and have, you know, all the scars, you know, you're helping me heal those scars that I think we all have. And so how do we bring it together? Not by might, not by power, but by the Spirit.
Yes.
That's kind of how I see, you know, that it's not going to be by power, this or that. It's something else there. And I believe in that. And so I have hope.
Wow. Wow. Dr. Aisha.
I think for me, the hope is very internal. And when I say internal, there is a very strong sense of responsibility that I feel right now as I am transitioning from being the doctoral student to now the subject matter expert, and what that title means, and what that means to my family, what that means to my siblings, what that means to the young Black and brown people that I sit across from, that look at me in awe when they say, "You're a psychologist at Duke," and how fancy that sounds. But I remember a day when it sounded fancy to me.
Wow.
And there's hope in that, because somebody took a moment to have a conversation that planted a seed, and then somebody prayed over that seed when I didn't know they were praying over that seed. Mm. And I've definitely, you know, had obstacles thrown my way in the worst way. You guys know I drag an oxygen tank in a backpack everywhere that I go. So there is hope. I think that's internal to this experience for myself. My scripture is John 9:4. I must work the work for he who has sent me while it is day, because night does come and no man can work. Wow. So while I will take my rest and I will respect the pause, I got work to do. And I have hope in the work that I'm doing. And God continues to manifest. I continue to get messages from students I ain't heard from in years that say, "Hey, I'm in my master's program and wow, I'm doing psychology," or, "Hey, I just want you to know I graduated," or, "Hey, that was a seed I planted that I didn't know I was planting. I was just doing my work." So there's hope in doing my work.
That is good.
Yeah,
that's good. That's good. And I believe that, and for me, my hope is everything that you all have said is so true. Just in keeping in consideration, whether it's about racial reconciliation, coming together, all of these things, that my brothers and sisters that are in the white community, Spanish community, whatever the case may be, it's all God's church. It's all part of the body of Christ. And my hope is in knowing that God is cleaning up his church. So I can point a finger and say, "Well, they're not right, or we're not right, or this not her." But the responsibility of cleaning up, getting the bride ready, that's happening anyway. That's going to happen whether or not we wanted to or not, or whatever way we wanted to, God is responsible for that. And I'm so that my hope is in him. And there's some ugly moments, ugly times. But he's still getting his bride ready.
Yes.
Still getting his bride ready. So I'm not going to get in the way. I'm gonna do my part, and I'm not gonna get in the way. And so I'm so grateful for each and every each of you, and grateful for you taking the time. I want to close out just a little lighter. Share with us what you're reading or a resource that you want our listeners to
to check out, something that you want them to check out, if a book or a resource that you've run across that you want to share with them. I'll start off, give you a moment to think about it. I downloaded a book that was referred to me. It is called, and I don't know if you guys have heard of this one yet or have read it yet, but it's called Biased by Jennifer Eberhardt.
Uncovering the Hidden Prejudice That Shapes What We See, Think, and Do.
What you know about that? What's...
Oh, you know.
All right. Yes. Called Biased. And so that's I've read a few pages of it so far. I'm going to keep reading it. But I have to finish my book. So I need to not read everyone else's book without having mine. Dr. Lattimore, we got to finish these books, right?
Yes.
All right. So what do you have? A book or a resource that you want to share with our listeners?
I'll share a book. I will tell you that I know this author, Dr. Annalise Singh, and the book is called The Racial Healing Handbook, Practical Activities to Help You Challenge Privilege, Confront Systemic Racism, and Engage in Collective Healing. I've started the book. And I will tell you that I'm kind of slow walking this thing because I'm treating it almost like a little Bible study. I'm taking notes, thinking of ways to engage the book that'll be helpful for me in my own healing journey and helping me as I'm working with students who are dealing with their healing journeys, specifically to systemic racism and, you know, being in a predominantly white supremacist culture in higher education. And it's been really helpful. And having some really like practical things that you can implement in your day to day to alleviate some of those stressors. So it's called The Racial Healing Handbook by Dr. Annalise Singh, S-I-N-G-H.
Got it. Thank you for sharing that. Sounds interesting. Thank you so much. All right, Dr. Brock.
Yes, I pushed this book. I'm not a paid spokesperson for this book. But I'm a fan of Dr. Dwight Hopkins, and he's come to be a good friend as well. And I've had quite a bit of time to spend with him as also, but he's the editor of a book called Black Faith in Public Talk, and I have it right here. Black Faith in Public Talk is critical essays on James Cone's Black Theology and Black Power. And we actually used that book when I was teaching adjunct at Oblate in our Intro to Black Church Studies class, but I think it just speaks very practically to the white silence, even now that we're hearing with regard to race issues. And I use that word intentionally, the white silence that we're hearing.
Yes, sir.
In America and... So I strongly recommend this book. It's actually a book that I'm going back through and not necessarily reading for the sake of getting finished with it, but really taking my time to reflect on a daily basis.
That's good. Good. Okay. Dr. Lattimore?
I had to go because I was running a brain freeze on that one. Our Daily Bread has a voices collection, and there's a series, it's a film series called In... Pursuit of Jesus, and it's videos in where I think his name is Rasul Berry is he's a minister in Brooklyn, and he's going across the world and he's asking people how they worship Jesus, how they interact with Jesus. And one of the episodes, they go to South Africa, and I had the opportunity to go to South Africa last May, not this May but the previous May. Mm-hmm. And you know, in a society that had all this apartheid and stuff like that, he was finding these multiracial churches in this space, in a multiracial apartheid society, yet there was a space. And so it's an interesting thing because he's got different cities. They go to Singapore, they're in the US, they're all across the world. And it's just engaging where you just sit down and people are talking about Jesus. And then I'm finishing my book, so I'm finishing editing. It's an editing thing now, so I think it'll be fully, it's, you know, the second editing phase is through with my editor, so it's in a good place. So I've just been reading a lot of historical stuff. There's this great book by a guy named Marinovich on gospel music. And I'm trying to remember the topic of it, but I'll stop there. I'll get the topic for you, and I'll let you post it.
All right. All right. Definitely get us that. It's because we need some music and some good soul stirring inspiration. But the video series called In Pursuit of Jesus.
With Our Daily Bread. You can find it on Our Daily Bread Voices. Got it. Or Our Daily Bread Films. And you can also search it on YouTube. It's there as well. Each episode is like 10 minutes to 12 minutes. So it's really short for everybody to be able to see. And it's great.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much. Well, I want to wrap up. You all have been a tremendous blessing. This conversation has blessed me. And I know that it is blessing those who are listening. We want to thank you for allowing us to be able to pick your brain a little bit and just to hear what you have to say in reference to the pandemic and all that has been taking place with the racial climate. We didn't talk specifically about protests. I think you all have given us so much to chew on, so much to think about. And so maybe I can have you all back. We could talk about some other things as all of this, as the dust settles, as we start seeing what things take place. But you've challenged us and given us some things to think about. And I pray that those who are listening will listen to the things that have been mentioned, and that in your own individual ministries, your own individual lives, that you too will look and examine where you stand with certain aspects that were mentioned and discussed, and self-reflect. But as we talked about at the very beginning, as Dr. Aisha emphasized, make sure you are healthy. Make sure you are in a good place. We can't even have conversations about race and get bringing folks together and expanding our churches and doing all of that if we're not healthy. Let's make sure that we are healthy so that we could take care of the people of God. Thank you for tuning in to Church Unfiltered. Thank you all. Dr. Aisha, Dr. Lattimore, Dr. Brock, thank you for joining us here on Church Unfiltered.
Thank you.
God bless.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Church Unfiltered with Dr. Anthony Cobbs. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast so you don't miss an episode. For more resources related to today's topic, visit churchunfiltered.com or follow Dr. Anthony Cobbs on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.